6. With this, it becomes manifest that the physical notion of necessity too has a religious origin. It must not be forgotten that the mechanical necessity that rules in what our intellects comprehend as nature is founded upon another necessity which is organic and fateful in life itself. The latter creates, the former restricts. One follows from inward certitude, the other from demonstration. That is the distinction between tragic and technical, historical and physical logic. There are further differences within the necessity postulated and assumed by science, that of cause and effect, which have so far eluded the keenest sight. We are confronted here with a question at once of very great difficulty and of superlative importance. A nature knowledge is, however philosophy may express the relation, a function of knowing, which is in each case knowing in a particular style. A scientific necessity, therefore, has the style of the appropriate intellect, and this brings morphological differences into the field at once. It is possible to see a strict necessity in nature, even where it may be impossible to express it in natural laws. In fact, natural laws, which for us are self-evidently the proper expression form in science, are not by any means so for the men of other cultures. They presuppose a quite special form, the distinctively Faustian form of understanding and therefore of nature knowing. There is nothing inherently absurd in the conception of a mechanical necessity wherein each individual case is morphologically self-contained and never exactly reproduced, in which therefore the acquisitions of knowledge cannot be put into consistently valid formulae. In such a case, nature would appear, to put it metaphorically, as an unending decimal that was also non-recurring, destitute of periodicity. And so, undoubtedly, it was conceived by classical minds. The feeling of it manifestly underlies their primary physical concepts. For example, the proper motion of Democritus's atoms is such as to exclude any possibility of calculating motions in advance. Nature laws are forms of the known in which an aggregate of individual cases are brought together as a unit of higher degree. Living time is ignored. That is, it does not matter whether, when, or how often the case arises, for the question is not of chronological sequence, but of mathematical consequence. But in the consciousness that no power in the world can shake this calculation lies our will to command over nature. That is Faustian. It is only from this standpoint that miracles appear as breaches of the laws of nature. Magian man saw in them merely the exercise of a power that was not common to all, not in any way a contradiction of the laws of nature. And classical man, according to Protagoras, was only the measure and not the creator of things, a view that unconsciously foregoes all conquest of nature through the discovery and application of laws. We see then that the causality principle, in the form in which it is self-evidently necessary for us, the agreed basis of truth for our mathematics, physics, and philosophy, is a Western, and more strictly speaking, a Baroque phenomenon. It cannot be proved, for every proof set forth in a Western language and every experiment conducted by a Western mind presupposes itself. In every problem, the enunciation contains the proof in germ. The method of a science is the science itself. Beyond question, the notion of laws of nature and the conception of physics as scientia experimentalis, which has held ever since Roger Bacon, contains, a priori, this specific kind of necessity. The classical mode of regarding nature, the alter ego of the classical mode of being, on the contrary, does not contain it. And yet it does not appear that the scientific position is weakened in logic thereby. If we work carefully through the utterances of Democritus, Anaxagoras, and Aristotle, in whom is contained the whole sum of classical nature speculation, and above all, if we examine the connotations of key terms like aliosis, ananke, entelechia, we look with astonishment into a world image totally unlike our own. This world image is self-sufficing, and therefore, for this definite sort of mankind, unconditionally true. And causality, in our sense, plays no part therein. The alchemist or philosopher of the Arabian culture, too, assumes a necessity within his world cavern that is utterly and completely different from the necessity of dynamics. There is no causal nexus of law form, but only one cause, God, immediately underlying every effect. To believe in nature laws would, from this standpoint, be to doubt the almightiness of God. If a rule seems to emerge, it is because it pleases God so. But to suppose that this rule was a necessity would be to yield to a temptation of the devil. This was the attitude also of Carneades, Plotinus, and the Neo-Pythagoreans. This necessity underlies the Gospels as it does the Talmud and the Avesta, and upon it rests the technique of alchemy. The conception of number as function is related to the dynamic principle of cause and effect. Both are creations of the same intellect, expression forms of the same spirituality, formative principles of the same objectivized and become nature. In fact, the physics of Democritus differs from the physics of Newton in that the chosen starting point of the one is the optically given, while that of the other is abstract relations that have been deduced from it. The facts of Apollinean nature knowledge are things, and they lie on the surface of the known. But the facts of Faustian science are relations, which in general are invisible to lay eyes, which have to be mastered intellectually, which require for their communication a code language that only the expert researcher can fully understand. The classical static necessity is immediately evident in the changing phenomena, while the dynamic causation principle prevails beyond things, and its tendency is to weaken, or to abolish even, their sensible actuality. Consider, for example, the world of significance that is connected, under present-day hypotheses, with the expression a magnet. The principle of the conservation of energy, which since its enunciation by J.R. Mayer has been regarded in all seriousness as a plain conceptual necessity, is in fact a redescription of the dynamic principle of causality by means of the physical concept of force. The appeal to experience and the controversy as to whether judgment is necessary or empirical, i.e. in the language of Kant, who greatly deceived himself about the highly fluid boundaries between the two, whether it is a priori or a posteriori certain, are characteristically Western. Nothing seems to us more self-evident and unambiguous than experience as the source of exact science. The Faustian experiment, based on working hypotheses and employing the methods of measurement, is nothing but the systematic and exhaustive exploitation of this experience. But no one has noticed that a whole worldview is implicit in such a concept of experience, with its aggressive dynamic connotation, and that there is not and cannot be experience in this pregnant sense for men of other cultures. When we decline to recognize the scientific results of Anaxagoras or Democritus as experiential results, it does not mean that these classical thinkers were incapable of interpreting and merely threw off fancies, but that we miss in their generalizations that causal element which for us constitutes experience in our sense of the word. Manifestly, we have never yet given adequate thought to the singularity of this, the pure Faustian conception of experience. The contrast between it and faith is obvious and entirely superficial. For indeed, exact sensuous intellectual experience is, in point of structure, completely congruent with that heart experience, as we may well call it, that illumination which deep religious natures of the West, Pascal, for instance, whom one and the same necessity made mathematician and Jansenist, have known in the significant moments of their being. Experience means to us an activity of the intellect, which does not resignedly confine itself to receiving, acknowledging, and arranging momentary and purely present impressions, but seeks them out and calls them up in order to overcome them in their sensuous presence, and to bring them into an unbounded unity in which their sensuous discreteness is dissolved. Experience, in our sense, possesses the tendency from particular to infinite, and for that very reason it is in contradiction with the feeling of classical science. What for us is the way to acquire experience is for the Greek the way to lose it, and therefore he kept away from the drastic method of experiment. Therefore his physics, instead of being a mighty system of worked-out laws and formulae that strong-handedly override the sense present, only knowledge is power, is an aggregate of impressions, well-ordered, intensified by sensuous imagery, clean-edged, which leaves nature intact in its self-completeness. Our exact natural science is imperative. The classical is theoria, in the literal sense, the result of passive contemplativeness. 7. We can now say without any hesitation that the form world of a natural science corresponds to those of the appropriate mathematic, the appropriate religion, the appropriate art. A deep mathematician, by which is meant not a master computer, but a man, any man, who feels the spirit of numbers living within him, realizes that through it he knows God. Pythagoras and Plato knew this as well as Pascal and Leibniz did so. Terentius Varro, in his examination of the old Roman religion dedicated to Julius Caesar, distinguished with Roman seriousness between the Theologia Civilis, the sum of officially recognized belief, the Theologia Mythica, the imagination world of poets and artists, and the Theologia Physica, of philosophical speculation. Applying this to the Faustian culture, that which Thomas Aquinas and Luther, Calvin and Loyola taught belongs to the first category. Dante and Goethe belong to the second, and to the third belongs scientific physics, inasmuch as behind its formulae there are images. Not only primitive man and the child, but also the higher animals spontaneously evolve from the small everyday experiences an image of nature which contains the sum of technical indications observed as recurrent. The eagle knows the moment at which to swoop down on the prey. The singing bird sitting on the eggs knows the approach of the martin. The deer finds the place where there is food. In man, this experience of all the senses has narrowed and deepened itself into experience of the eye. But as the habit of verbal speech has now been superadded, understanding comes to be abstracted from seeing, and thenceforth develops independently as reasoning. To the instantly comprehending technique is added the reflective theory. Technique applies itself to visible near things and plain needs, theory to the distance and the terrors of the invisible. By the side of the petty knowledge of everyday life, it sets up belief. And still they evolve. There is a new knowledge and a new and higher technique, and to the myth there is added the cult. The one teaches how to know the noumena, the other how to conquer them. For theory, in the eminent sense, is religious through and through. It is only in quite late states that scientific theory evolves out of religious, through men having become aware of methods. Apart from this, there is little alteration. The image world of physics remains mythic. Its procedure remains a cult of conjuring the powers in things, and the images that it forms and the methods that it uses remain generically dependent upon those of the appropriate religion. From the later days of the Renaissance onward, the notion of God has steadily approximated, in the spirit of every man of high significance, to the idea of pure, endless space. The God of Ignatius Loyola's Exercitia Spiritualis is the God also of Luther's Ein Fester Berg, of the Improperia of Palestrina and the Cantatas of Bach. He is no longer the father of St. Francis of Assisi and the high-vaulted cathedrals, the personally present, caring and mild God felt by Gothic painters like Giotto and Stefan Lochner, but an impersonal principle, unimaginable, intangible, working mysteriously in the infinite. Every relic of personality dissolves into insensible abstraction, such a divinity as only instrumental music of the grand style is capable of representing, a divinity before which painting breaks down and drops into the background. This God-feeling it was that formed the scientific world image of the West, its nature, its experience, and therefore its theories and its methods, in direct contradiction to those of the classical. The force which moves the mass, that is what Michelangelo painted in the Sistine Chapel. That is what we feel growing more and more intense from the archetype of Il Gesù to the climax in the cathedral facades of Della Porta and Maderna, and from Heinrich Schütz to the transcendent tone worlds of 18th century church music. That is what, in Shakespearean tragedy, fills with world-becoming scenes widened to infinity. And that is what Galileo and Newton captured in formulae and concepts. The word God rings otherwise under the vaulting of Gothic cathedrals or in the cloisters of Maulbronn and St. Gallen than in the basilicas of Syria and the temples of Republican Rome. The character of the Faustian cathedral is that of the forest. The mighty elevation of the nave above the flanking aisles, in contrast to the flat roof of the basilica. The transformation of the columns, which with base and capital had been set as self-contained individuals in space, into pillars and clustered pillars that grow up out of the earth and spread on high into an infinite subdivision and interlacing of lines and branches. The giant windows by which the wall is dissolved and the interior filled with mysterious light. These are the architectural actualizing of a world feeling that had found the first of all its symbols in the high forest of the northern plains, the deciduous forest with its mysterious tracery, its whispering of ever-mobile foliage over men's heads, its branches straining through the trunks to be free of earth. Think of Romanesque ornamentation and its deep affinity to the sense of the woods. The endless, lonely twilight wood became and remained the secret wistfulness in all Western building forms, so that when the form energy of the style died down, in late Gothic as in closing Baroque, the controlled abstract line language resolved itself immediately into naturalistic branches, shoots, twigs and leaves. Cypresses and pines with their corporeal and Euclidean effect could never have become symbols of unending space. But the oaks, beeches and lindens, with the fitful light flecks playing in their shadow-filled volume, are felt as bodiless, boundless, spiritual. The stem of the cypress finds conclusive fulfilment of its vertical tendency in the defined columniation of its cone masses. But that of an oak seems, ever restless and unsatisfied, to strain beyond its summit. In the ash, the victory of the upstriving branches over the unity of the crown seems actually to be won. Its aspect is of something dissolving, something expanding into space, and it was for this probably that the world ash Yggdrasil became a symbol in the northern mythology. The rustle of the woods, a charm that no classical poet ever felt, for it lies beyond the possibilities of Apollinian nature feeling, stands with its secret questions, whence, whither, its merging of presence into eternity, in a deep relation with destiny, with the feeling of history and duration, with the quality of direction that impels the anxious, caring Faustian soul towards infinitely distant future. And for that reason, the organ that roars deep and high through our churches in tones which, compared with the plain, solid notes of Aulos and Kythera, seem to know neither limit nor restraint, is the instrument of instruments in Western devotions. Cathedral and organ form a symbolic unity like temple and statue. The history of organ building, one of the most profound and moving chapters of our musical history, is a history of longing for the forest, a longing to speak in the language of that true temple of Western God-fearing. From the verse of Wolfram von Eschenbach to the music of Tristan, this longing has borne fruit unceasingly. Orchestra tones strove tirelessly in the 18th century towards a nearer kinship with the organ tone. The word schwebend, floating, meaningless as applied to classical things, is important alike in the theory of music, in oil painting, in architecture, and in the dynamic physics of the Baroque. Stand in a high wood of mighty stems while the storm is tearing above, and you will comprehend instantly the full meaning of the concept of a force which moves mass. Out of such a primary feeling in the existence that has become thoughtful, there arises then an idea of the divine imminent in the world around, and this idea becomes steadily more definite. The thoughtful percipient takes in the impression of motion in outer nature. He feels about him an almost indescribable alien life of unknown powers, and traces the origin of these effects to noumena, to the other, inasmuch as this other also possesses life. Astonishment at alien motion is the source of religion and of physics both. Respectively, they are the elucidations of nature, world around, by the soul and by the reason. The powers are the first object both of fearful or loving reverence and of critical investigation. There is a religious experience and a scientific experience. Now it is important to observe how the consciousness of the culture intellectually concretes its primary noumena. It imposes significant words, names, on them, and there conjures, seizes, or bounds them. By virtue of the name, they are subject to the intellectual power of the man who possesses the name. And, as has been shown already, the whole of philosophy, the whole of science, and everything that is related in any way to knowing is, at the very bottom, nothing but an infinitely refined mode of applying the name magic of the primitive to the alien. The pronouncement of the right name, in physics the right concept, is an incantation. Deities and basic notions of science alike come into being first as vocable names, with which is linked an idea that tends to become more and more sensuously definite. The outcome of a noumen is a deus. The outcome of a notion is an idea. In the mere naming of thing in itself, atom, energy, gravitation, cause, evolution, and the like, is for most learned men the same sense of deliverance as there was for the peasant of Latium in the words Ceres, Consus, Janus, Vesta. Footnote. And it may be asserted that the downright faith that Haeckel, for example, pins to the names atom, matter, energy, is not essentially different from the fetishism of Neanderthal man. End of footnote. For the classical world feeling, conformably to the Apollinian depth experience and its symbolism, the individual body was being. Logically, therefore, the form of this body, as it presented itself in the light, was felt as its essence, as the true purport of the word being. What has not shape, what is not a shape, is not at all. On the basis of this feeling, which was of an intensity that we can hardly imagine, the classical spirit created as counter-concept to the form of the other, non-form, viz. Stuff, arche, principle, oule, material, that which in itself possesses no being and is merely complement to the actual ent, representing a secondary and corollary necessity. In these conditions, it is easy to see how the classical pantheon inevitably shaped itself as a higher mankind side by side with the common mankind, as a set of perfectly formed bodies of high possibilities, incarnate and present, but in the unessential of stuff not distinguished, and therefore subject to the same cosmic and tragic necessity. It is otherwise that the Faustian world feeling experiences depth. Here the sum of true being appears as pure efficient space, which is being, and therefore what is sensuously felt, what is very significantly designated the plenum, das Raumerfüllende, is felt as a fact of the second order, as something questionable or specious, as a resistance that must be overcome by philosopher or physicist before the true content of being can be discovered. Western scepticism has never been directed against space, always against tangible things only. Space is the higher idea. Force is only a less abstract expression for it. And it is only as a counter-concept to space that mass arises. For mass is what is in space, and is logically and physically dependent upon space. From the assumption of a wave motion of light, which underlies the conception of light as a form of energy, the assumption of a corresponding mass, the luminiferous ether, necessarily followed. A definition of mass and description of properties to mass follows from the definition of force, and not vice versa, with all the necessity of a symbol. All classical notions of substantiality, however they differed amongst themselves as realist or idealist, distinguish a to-be-formed, that is, a nonent, which only receives closer definition from the basic concept of form, whatever this form may be in the particular philosophical system. All Western notions of substantiality distinguish a to-be-moved, which also is a negative, no doubt, but one polar to a different positive. Form and non-form, force and non-force. These words render as clearly as may be the polarities that in the two cultures underlie the world impression and contain all its modes. That which comparative philosophy has hitherto rendered inaccurately and misleadingly by the one word matter signifies, in the one case, the substratum of shape, in the other, the substratum of force. No two notions could differ more completely. For here it is the feeling of God, a sense of values, that is speaking. The classical deity is superlative shape, the Faustian superlative force. The other is the ungodly, to which the spirit will not accord the dignity of being. To the Apollinian world feeling, this ungodly other is substance without shape. To the Faustian, it is substance without force. 8. Scientists are wont to assume that myths and God ideas are creations of primitive man, and that as spiritual culture advances, this myth-forming power is shed. In reality, it is the exact opposite, and had not the morphology of history remained to this day an almost unexplored field, the supposedly universal mythopoetic power would long ago have been found to be limited to particular periods. It would have been realized that this ability of a soul to fill its world with shapes, traits, and symbols, like and consistent amongst themselves, belongs most decidedly not to the world age of the primitives, but exclusively to the springtimes of great cultures. Every myth of the great style stands at the beginning of an awakening spirituality. It is the first formative act of that spirituality. Nowhere else is it to be found. There it must be. I make the assumption that that which a primitive folk, like the Egyptians of Sinite times, the Jews and Persians before Cyrus, the heroes of the Mycenaean boroughs, and the Germans of the migrations, possess in the way of religious ideas, is not yet myth in the higher sense. It may well be a sum of scattered and irregular traits, of cults adhering to names, fragmentary saga pictures, but it is not yet a divine order, a mythic organism. And I no more regard this as myth than I regard the ornament of that stage as art. And, be it said, the greatest caution is necessary in dealing with the symbols and sagas current today, or even those current centuries ago, amongst ostensibly primitive peoples. For in those thousands of years, every country in the world has been more or less affected by some high culture alien to it. There are, therefore, as many form worlds of great myth as there are cultures and early architectures. The antecedents, that chaos of undeveloped imagery in which modern folklore research, for want of a guiding principle, loses itself, do not on this hypothesis concern us, but we are concerned, on the other hand, with certain cultural manifestations that have never yet been thought of as belonging to this category. It was in the Homeric Age, 1100 to 800 BC, and in the corresponding Knightly Age of Teutonism, 900 to 1200 AD, that is, the Epic Ages, and neither before nor after them, that the great world image of a new religion came into being. The corresponding ages in India and Egypt are the Vedic and the Pyramid periods. One day it will be discovered that Egyptian mythology did in fact ripen into depth during the 3rd and 4th dynasties. Only in this way can we understand the immense wealth of religious intuitive creations that fills the 3 centuries of the imperial age in Germany. What came into existence then was the Faustian mythology. Hitherto, owing to religious and learned preconceptions, either the Catholic element has been treated to the exclusion of the northern heathen, or vice versa, and consequently we have been blind to the breadth and the unity of this form world. In reality, there is no such difference. The deep change of meaning in the Christian circle of ideas is identical, as a creative act, with the consolidation of the old heathen cults of the migrations. It was in this age that the folklore of Western Europe became an entirety. If the bulk of its material was far older, and if far later again it came to be linked with new outer experiences and enriched by more conscious treatment, yet it was then, and neither earlier nor later, that it was vitalized with its symbolic meaning. To this lore belonged the great god legends of the Edda, and many motifs in the gospel poetry of learned monks. The German hero tales of Siegfried and Gudrun, Dietrich and Wieland. The vast wealth of chivalry tales, derived from ancient Celtic fables, that was simultaneously coming to harvest on French soil, concerning King Arthur and the Round Table, the Holy Grail, Tristan, Percival and Roland. And with these are to be counted, beside the spiritual transvaluation, unremarked but all the deeper for that, of the Passion story, the Catholic hagiology, of which the richest floraison was in the 10th and 11th centuries, and which produced the Lives of the Virgin and the histories of Saints Roch, Sibelt, Severin, Francis, Bernard, Odilia. The Legenda Aurea was composed about 1250. This was the blossoming time of courtly epic and Icelandic skald poetry alike. The great Valhalla gods of the north and the mythic group of the 14 helpers in South Germany are contemporary, and by the side of Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods, in Völuspá we have a Christian form in the South German Mispili. This great myth develops, like heroic poetry, at the climax of the early culture. They both belong to the two primary estates, priesthood and nobility. They are at home in the cathedral and the castle, and not in the village below, where amongst the people the simple saga world lives on for centuries, called fairy tale, popular beliefs, or superstition, and yet inseparable from the world of high contemplation. Nowhere is the final meaning of these religious creations more clearly indicated than in the history of Valhalla. It was not an original German idea, and even the tribes of the migrations were totally without it. It took shape just at this time, instantly, and as an inward necessity in the consciousness of the peoples newly arisen on the soil of the West. Thus it is contemporary with Olympus, which we know from the Homeric epos, and which is as little Mycenaean as Valhalla is German in origin. Moreover, it is only for the two higher estates that Valhalla emerges from the notion of hell. In the beliefs of the people, hell remained the realm of the dead. The deep inward unity of this Faustian world of myth and saga, and the complete congruence of its expression symbolism, has never hitherto been realized, and yet Siegfried, Baldur, Roland, Christ the King in the Heliand are different names for one and the same figure. Valhalla and Avalon, the Round Table and the Communion of the Grail Templars, Mary, Fricka and Frau Holle mean the same. On the other hand, the external provenance of the material motifs and elements, on which mythological research has wasted an excessive zeal, is a matter of which the importance does not go deeper than the surface. As to the meaning of a myth, its provenance proves nothing. The noumen itself, the primary form of the world feeling, is a pure, necessary, and unconscious creation, and it is not transferable. What one people takes over from another, in conversion or in admiring imitation, is a name, dress and mask for its own feeling, never the feeling of that other. The old Celtic and old Germanic myth motifs have to be treated, like the repertory of classical forms possessed by the learned monk, and like the entire body of the Christian Eastern faith taken over by the Western Church, simply as the material out of which the Faustian soul in these centuries created a mythic architecture of its own. It mattered little whether the persons through whose minds and mouths the myth came to life were individual skalds, missionaries, priests, or the people, nor did the circumstance that the Christian ideas dictated its forms affect the inward independence of that which had come to life. In the classical, Arabian and Western cultures, the myth of the springtime is in each case that which we should expect. In the first, static, in the second, Magian, in the third, dynamic. Examine every detail of form and see how in the classical it is an attitude and in the West a deed, there a being and here a will that underlies them. How in the classical the bodily and tangible, the sensuously saturated, prevails, and how, therefore, in the mode of worshipping, the centre of gravity lies in the sense-impressive cult, whereas in the North it is space, force, and therefore a religiousness that is predominantly dogmatic in colouring that rule. These very earliest creations of the young soul tell us that there is relationship between the Olympian figures, the statue and the corporeal Doric temple, between the dominical basilica, the spirit of God and the arabesque, between Valhalla and the Mary myth, the soaring nave and instrumental music. The Arabian soul built up its myth in the centuries between Caesar and Constantine, that fantastic mass of cults, visions and legends that today we can hardly even survey. Syncretic cults like that of the Syrian Baal and of Isis and Mithras, not only transported to, but transformed in Syrian soil. Gospels, Acts of Apostles, and the Apocalypses in astonishing profusion. Christian, Persian, Jewish, Neoplatonist and Manichaean legends, and the heavenly hierarchy of angels and spirits of the fathers and the Gnostics. In the suffering story of the Gospels, the very epic of the Christian nation, set between the story of Jesus' childhood and the Acts of the Apostles, and in the Zoroaster legend that is contemporary with it, we are looking upon the hero figures of early Arabian epic, as we see Achilles in the classical and Siegfried and Percival in the Faustian. The scenes of Gethsemane and Golgotha stand beside the noblest pictures of Greek and Germanic saga. These Magian visions, almost without exception, grew up under the pressure of the dying classical, which, in the nature of things unable to communicate its spirit, the more insistently lent its forms. It is almost impossible now to estimate the extent to which given Apollinian elements had to be accepted and transvalued before the old Christian myth assumed the firmness that it possessed in the time of Augustine. 9. The classical polytheism, consequently, has a style of its own which puts it in a different category from the conceptions of any other world feelings, whatever the superficial affinities may be. This mode of possessing gods without godhead has only existed once, and it was in the one culture that made the statue of naked man the whole sum of its art. Nature, as classical man felt and knew it about him, viz., a sum of well-formed bodily things, could not be deified in any other form but this. The Roman felt that the claim of Yahweh to be recognized as sole God had something atheistic in it. One God, for him, was no God, and to this may be ascribed the strong dislike of popular feeling, both Greek and Roman, for the philosophers, insofar as they were pantheists and godless. Gods are bodies, somata of the perfectest kind, and plurality was an attribute of bodies alike for mathematicians, lawyers, and poets. The concept of zoon politikon was valid for gods as well as for men. Nothing was more alien to them than oneness, solitariness, and self-adequacy, and no existence therefore was possible to them save under the aspect of eternal propinquity. It is a deeply significant fact that in Hellas, of all countries, star gods, the noumena of the far, are wanting. Helios was worshipped only in half-oriental Rhodes, and Selene had no cult at all. Both are merely artistic modes of expression. It is as such only that they figure in the courtly epos of Homer, elements that Varro would class in the genus mythicum and not in the genus civile. The old Roman religion, in which the classical world feeling was expressed with special purity, knew neither sun nor moon, neither storm nor cloud as deities. The forest stirrings and the forest solitude, the tempest and the surf, which completely dominated the nature of Faustian man, even that of pre-Faustian Celts and Teutons, and imparted to their mythology its peculiar character, left classical man unmoved. Only concretes, hearth and door, the coppice and the plot field, this particular river and that particular hill, condensed into being for him. We observe that everything that has farness, everything that contains a suggestion of unbounded and unbodied in it, and might thereby bring space as ent and divine into the felt nature, is excluded and remains excluded from classical myth. How should it surprise, then, if clouds and horizons, that are the very meaning and soul of Baroque landscapes, are totally wanting in the classical backgroundless frescoes? The unlimited multitude of antique gods, every tree, every spring, every house, nay, every part of a house is a god, means that every tangible thing is an independent existence, and therefore that none is functionally subordinate to any other. The bases of the Apollinian and the Faustian nature images, respectively, are in all contexts the two opposite symbols of individual thing and unitary space. Olympus and Hades are perfectly sense-definite places, while the kingdom of the dwarfs, elves and goblins, and Valhalla and Niflheim are all somewhere or other in the universe of space. In the old Roman religion, Tellus Mater is not the All-Mother, but the visible, ploughable field itself. Faunus is the wood, and Volturnus is the river. The name of the seed is Ceres, and that of the harvest is Consus. Horace is a true Roman when he speaks of sub juve frigido, under the cold sky. In these cases, there is not even the attempt to reproduce the god in any sort of image at the places of worship, but that would be tantamount to duplicating him. Even in very late times, the instinct not only of the Romans but of the Greeks also is opposed to idols, as is shown by the fact that plastic art, as it became more and more profane, came into conflict more and more with popular beliefs and the devout philosophy. In the house, Janus is the door as god, Vesta the hearth as goddess. The two functions of the house are objectivized and deified at once. A Hellenic river god, like Achelous, who appears as a bull, is definitely understood as being the river and not as, so to say, dwelling in the river. The Pans and Satyrs are the fields and meadows as Noon defines them, well-bounded and, as having figure, having also existence. Dryads and Hamadryads are trees. In many places, indeed, individual trees of great stature were honoured with garlands and votive offerings without even the formality of a name. On the contrary, not a trace of this localised materiality clings to the elves, dwarfs, witches, valkyries and their kindred, the armies of departed souls that sweep round o' nights. Whereas naiads are sources, nixies and hags, and tree spirits and brownies are souls that are only bound to sources, trees and houses, from which they long to be released into the freedom of roaming. This is the very opposite of the plastic nature feeling, for here things are experienced merely as spaces of another kind. A nymph, a spring that is, assumes human form when she would visit a handsome shepherd. But a nixie is an enchanted princess with nenuphars in her hair who comes up at midnight from the depths of the pool wherein she dwells. Kaiser Barbarossa sits in the Kufheiser cavern and Frau Venus in the Horselburg. It is as though the Faustian universe abhorred anything material and impenetrable. In things, we suspect other worlds. Their hardness and thickness is merely appearance and, a trait that would be impossible in classical myth because fatal to it, some favoured mortals are accorded the power to see through cliffs and crags into the depths. But is not just this the secret intent of our physical theories, of each new hypothesis? No other culture knows so many fables of treasures lying in mountains and pools, of secret subterranean realms, palaces, gardens, wherein other beings dwell. The whole substantiality of the visible world is denied by the Faustian nature feeling, for which in the end nothing is of earth, and the only actual is space. The fairy tale dissolves the matter of nature as the Gothic style dissolves the stone mass of our cathedrals into a ghostly wealth of forms and lines that have shed all weight and acknowledge no bounds. The ever-increasing emphasis with which classical polytheism somatically individualized its deities is peculiarly evident in its attitude to strange gods. For classical man, the gods of the Egyptians, the Phoenicians, and the Germans, insofar as they could be imagined as figures, were as real as his own gods. Within his world feeling, the statement that such other gods do not exist would have no meaning. When he came into contact with the countries of these deities, he did them reverence. The gods were, like a statue or a polis, Euclidean bodies having locality. They were beings of the near and not the general space. If a man was sojourning in Babylon, for instance, and Zeus and Apollo were far away, all the more reason for particularly honouring the local gods. This is the meaning of the altars dedicated to the unknown gods, such as that which Paul so significantly misunderstood in a Magian monotheistic sense at Athens. These were gods not known by name to the Greek, but worshipped by the foreigners of the great seaports, Piraeus, Corinth, or other, and therefore entitled to their due of respect from him. Rome expressed this with classical clearness in her religious law and in carefully preserved formulae like, for example, the Generalis Invocatio. As the universe is the sum of things, and as gods are things, recognition had to be accorded even to those gods with whom the Roman had not yet practically and historically come into relations. He did not know them, or he knew them as the gods of his enemies, but they were gods, for it was impossible for him to conceive the opposite. This is the meaning of the sacral phrase in Livy, Book 8, Chapter 9, Verse 6, De quibus est potestas nostrorum hostiumque. The Roman people admits that the circle of its own gods is only momentarily bounded, and after reciting these by name, it ends the prayer thus, so as not to infringe the rights of others. According to its sacral law, the annexation of foreign territory involves the transfer to urbs Roma of all the religious obligations pertaining to this territory and its gods, which of course logically follows from the additive god feeling of the classical. Recognition of a deity was very far from being the same as acceptance of the forms of its cult. Thus, in the Second Punic War, the great mother of Pausanias was received in Rome as the Sibyl commanded, but the priests who had come in with her cult, which was of a highly unclassical complexion, practiced under strict police supervision, and not only Roman citizens, but even their slaves were forbidden under penalty to enter this priesthood. The reception of the goddess gave satisfaction to the classical world feeling, but the personal performance of her despised ritual would have infringed it. The attitude of the Senate in such cases is unmistakable, though the people, with its ever-increasing admixture of Eastern elements, had a liking for these cults, and in imperial times the army became, in virtue of its composition, a vehicle, and even the chief vehicle, of the Magian world feeling. This makes it the easier to understand how the cult of deified men could become a necessary element in this religious form world. But here it is necessary to distinguish sharply between classical phenomena and oriental phenomena that have a superficial similarity thereto. Roman emperor worship, i.e. the reverence of the genius of the living princes and that of the dead predecessors as divi, has hitherto been confused with the ceremonial reverence of the ruler, which was customary in Asia Minor, and above all in Persia, and also with the later and quite differently meant caliph deification, which is seen in full process of formation in Diocletian and Constantine. Footnote. In Egypt, Ptolemy Philadelphus was the first to introduce a ruler cult. The reverence that had been paid to the pharaohs was of quite other significance. End of footnote. Actually, these are all very unlike things. However intimately these symbolic forms were interfused in the east of the empire, in Rome itself the classical type was actualized unequivocally and without adulteration. Long before this, certain Greeks, for example Sophocles, Lysander, and above all Alexander, had been not merely hailed as gods by their flatterers, but felt as gods in a perfectly definite sense by the people. It is only a step, after all, from the deification of a thing, such as a copse, or a well, or, in the limit, a statue which represented a god, to the deification of an outstanding man who became first hero and then god. In this case, as in the rest, what was reverenced was the perfect shape in which the world stuff, the undivine, had actualized itself. In Rome, the consul, on the day of his triumph, wore the armour of Jupiter Capitolinus, and in early days his face and arms were even painted red in order to enhance his similarity to the terracotta statue of the god whose numen he, for the time being, incorporated.